Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're asking, how do you design a front cover? We've just wrapped up the October issue of Monocle here at Midori House, and so the production process is firmly imprinted in our minds. Over the next half hour, I'll be joined by our creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell, who'll lift the lid on how we go about working the best bits out of the magazine and onto the front cover, if indeed that's what we do. And we're not just limiting this to magazines, of course. Adrian Shaughnessy is co-founder of Unit Editions, the independent publishing house making beautifully designed books for beautiful design-minded people. He will be in the studio with Rich and I to supply his own wisdom on how you make a reader judge a book by its cover. That's all ahead on Culture right here on Monocle 24. Rich and Adrian, welcome both to the programme. What we like to do sometimes on this show as well is bring people together who know each other's work but haven't actually met in person. So I think you guys have met for the first time as well. So I'm saying hello to you guys. You've got to say hello to each other.
Hi, Richard.
Hello, Adrian.
There we are. You see, that wasn't an awkward at all. We can be friends around this round table. Now, we're going to start with magazines, something that, well, you know, festoon the newsstands. In every railway station, airport and high street, we walk down fewer than before, perhaps. But maybe the good will out. Let's have a quick idea on that, Rich. Obviously, there's fewer front pages. There's a lot more thinner magazines on the newsstands these days than there were 10 years ago when we started Monocle. Do you maybe think that some of the quality has outed, the best stuff has survived, and that actually some of the front covers of the magazines are better now than they were 10 years ago? Or maybe there's a commercial imperative and maybe they've got less interesting? I wonder what you see when you take a quick scan of a high street retailer in the UK, for example.
Well, it's been a changing landscape for sure over the last 10 years. Print is on one side of the coin. It's struggling. It's horrible out there. But the other side of it is that actually a lot of chaff has gone, certainly, and print has become a more premium thing. I think it's become more beloved. People often are starting to compare it with vinyl and think that, you know, that print is just this lovely thing that we all just want to own and collect and put on our bookshelves. If there's a downside to it, I think that you have to be commercially extremely aware all the time, or that's certainly the pressure. And sadly, I think for lots of people, being commercial means having celebrities or being louder. And I don't always think that makes for a most creative solution. Cover design is a particular discipline, I think, and it's a little bit different from the discipline from within inside the magazine. The design of pages in a magazine is slightly different to what you do on the front cover. So it's an odd kind of process that we go through once a month.
It's an interesting one, isn't it, Adrian? We're going to move on to books in the second half of this programme. So let's try to highlight magazines right now. It's an interesting thing that Rich said, kind of saying it's a little bit like the vinyl boom, this kind of strange thing that sort of came out of nowhere. When music has become devalued, the best bits of it kind of become cherishable. Do you agree with that? Do you see that when you take a quick scan of a newsagent?
Yeah, very strongly. And I think there's some big underlining issues here that have created the situation. It's created the vinyl situation. It's created the renewed interest in print. And I think it's to do with the ephemeral nature of digital communications. You can't keep them. They vanish. They disappear. You know, I mean, how can you keep track of all the stuff that you look at throughout a day? It just vanishes. And I think we've been through that. We've all been seduced by that. We've all seen the benefits of it, because there are extraordinary benefits to digital communications of all kinds. And I think people have come out the other end now. There's an interesting thing. I mean, I know we're concentrating on magazines, but ebook sales dipped for the first time, I think, in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And, you know, anecdotally, when I sit on the tube, I see people reading paperbacks again, and I see people reading magazines. So I think there is an opportunity now. And for me, where I see it in the dozens of sort of underground magazines that have appeared, really beautifully crafted. Now, whether they make any money, whether it's all done for love, I don't know. But there's a huge resurgence in interest in niche magazines. And I think that's fantastic. I think that's really healthy.
Well, that's good. That kicks us off nicely into the realm then of magazines. We've talked about maybe the health of the market. We've talked about the fact that a scan across the newsstands, some of the big well-known names have disappeared or got thinner, but there's some more underground names up there and some more ink on the paper, perhaps. Maybe that paper is a bit more matte. It smells a little bit nicer. We're in a different realm than we were a decade ago. So let's try and get down to the nitty-gritty of what goes on that that front cover. Rich, I said in the introduction, it's about putting what's best of the magazine on the front. That is and isn't the case, isn't it? Sometimes we do something that's very different, that is a thought away from it. Sometimes we try to sum up everything that's in the sometimes 300-odd pages in Monocle on the front cover. At what point in the process, and you can be honest here, if it is very last minute, do we decide what goes on that front cover, whether we're going to shoot something separately or whether we're going to use something that was used in the magazine and use it in a different light? How and when does that process start?
I'll be honest, as you requested it, we kind of make it up every month as we go along. And of course, you can try and apply some sort of cover science to things. But someone said something to me a long time ago, which is you do what you have to do on the cover because it's the cover, and then do what you want in the rest of the magazine. And that is partly true. And an example of that would be a kind of a classic men's magazine front cover. There'll be a Hollywood starlet who's got a film coming out, no doubt. And she'll be, you know, on the front cover because of that. They've probably got the image for free, probably. And that celebrity will have a certain amount of pull. When you actually open that magazine, it's got, say, 300 pages. There'll be two other images of her,
yeah,
or he, and that will be it. The rest of the magazine won't be about Hollywood starlets. It will be about all sorts of other things. So some people go for that, play their most commercial card. I think what you have to do on a cover is just try and encapsulate the feeling of the month, what you want to try and convey. And I think you have to try and reinvent without changing too much each time out. And I always think you have to try and slightly surprise the reader. I think it's the surprising covers that make people stop and pick it up. That's probably why we do make some last-minute changes to covers, when we just think, actually, are we being surprising enough? Is this eye-catching? Is this saying what we want to say? And I guess we leave it late because that's the fun of being in print, I suppose. And it's a lot of fun.
And I'd just like to point out that Rich is definitely not putting inverted commas with his fingers here around the words. Adrian, you were nodding along to that.
Yeah, there was some really interesting things in what you were saying. And I thought the most relevant thing you said was this idea of surprise. And I remember when Monocle first appeared on the newsstands, it was a surprise. And to a certain extent, it still is. I mean, no question. It still is surprising because it isn't a typical, celebrity-led, big head, 500 hours of Photoshop. They're smart, literate, and often do things like I think the most recent one uses a cartoon. So I think what Monocle managed to do brilliantly was, and still does, is create that sense of surprise. But I share your utter kind of disappointment in what goes on in magazines. And I think there's something else interesting too, isn't there? And it's this thing about the power of the newsstand and how things look when they're racked up with hundreds of other magazines.
And you have to think that. You have to know top third of your magazine is going to look like. Presumably a lot of attention is paid to
that. Yeah, yeah. But of course, that's changing. And I think more and more people are subscribing. I don't know, I don't have any figures, but I think if you subscribe to a magazine, the cover doesn't have to do the same job because it comes to you. You don't have to go to it. And what I like about the sort of new generation of these sort of very, very heavily styled magazines is that they don't make any concessions to the newsstand. They just do what they have to do. I mean, the masthead will be at the top in most cases, but I totally understand that thing about surprise. And it seems to me that in so many areas, and more so in magazines than anything else, it's sameness that people value.
Yeah.
We must be like everybody else. Now, why? What's the logic? These are smart people running these magazines. Why can't they see that difference is actually what really matters?
Well, I think you need a certain degree of bravery. Mm. And it's hard in a challenging, print market to suddenly drop everything that your instincts are telling you not to do. You know, I can't imagine them having a conversation at Vogue to say, I tell you what, let's put Still Life on the cover, shall we?
Yeah.
Something from the high street.
Yeah.
You know, they would never do it. But of course, if they did, that would absolutely stand out because it would be doing what all of its neighbours aren't doing. And I think that was the problem with the men's market, which has been the one that's really collapsed in recent years because they all just look the same. They're all kind of chasing the same people.
Mm. And yeah, there will be one of those months where Leonardo DiCaprio is on the front cover of every magazine and Gisele Bündchen is on the... There is presumably a merry-go-round, a PR merry-go-round that rolls and rolls.
I mean, the one that always gets me is when there's a new Bond film out. I mean, lazy editors of the world rejoice. I mean, it's the best Bond girls, let's do a spread on an Aston Martin, Daniel Craig's on like seven covers, and you just think, my God, I just can't see another one of these.
Yeah.
Although, interestingly, whenever Daniel Craig's apparently on the front cover of Esquire magazine, their sales are the best they ever do. So there you go. You just kind of like, here's a classic example of, do we be brave and not put Daniel Craig on the cover? because he's our bestseller? You probably wouldn't. You probably would make a sensible business call and say, no, let's stick to what we know. We stick to what sells.
So in a sense, there's a way, there's an argument for redesigning the newsstand rather than necessarily redesigning the magazine. If we live in a universe, especially over the more crafted, the more artistically oriented, perhaps, even if they're a magazine about cinema, but they're artistically oriented towards cinema, but perhaps there is a case for having the newsstand redesigned around the magazine rather than vice versa. Because essentially that is a very old piece of design, sticking some magazines in frontwards, not sideways, and the top third of that title having to look sexy and attractive.
Yeah. Book retailers worked that out 10, 15 years ago when they realized if you presented books cover up on a table so that people saw them and could look at them rather than just racks of spines, which is what used to happen, but the odd bestseller turned to face you. And that revolutionized book retailing. Unfortunately, Amazon came along and dealt that one a blow, but it's coming back. And if you look at bookshops now, no one would do a bookshop where the book covers weren't facing you when you walked in. And what that did was that liberated book design. I'm going to talk about it later, but I think you're right. I think we're locked into this old way of selling magazines, and that has to change, but you know, it's like everything else, it will be slow and painful and might never happen.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the sort of science in inverted, we can maybe put that a bit like fun, Rich, in inverted commas. But some of the colours that we use, sometimes, you know, we use very pop colours. We say it pops, which means it stands out on the newsstand. We've used hot pink, as Adrian was talking about. We did a cartoon character on our front cover last time. We've done some cartoony things. We've done a thing with Sylvanian families and things like this, which have been really successful because I guess there's a bit of brand recognition built into it. Tell us about that. Tell us about the colour palette that is at your disposal on a front cover. What means summer? What's good for a new year? What just says buy me, I wonder?
Well, there are some sort of industry rules. Black and white images don't sell. You can prove that wrong. We've done that in the past. And that green covers, green mastheads apparently don't sell. But again, we've put green on the cover and actually that issue did very well. That, I think, comes back to surprising your audience. If you surprise, I don't think they're going to be turned off by a black and white image or a green color. In terms of our color palette, Monocle, not to be too pompous about it, we think of it as a brand. It is a brand. It's more than just a magazine. And as you go back to the sort of put your graphic designer cap on, you have a color world, a brand color world, and that has developed over 10 years. But there are certain colors we wouldn't use that wouldn't be Monocle, just in the same way that there are certain colors that, you know, wouldn't be.
We've done a lot of fluoro orange, have we? That was a big, I mean, thinking about big men's magazines, GQs and Esquires of this world, there was a big fluoro orange movement.
Well, there was. And for us, we've used quite a lot of yellow. But the thing you have to remember about Monocle is, of course, it's a black cover. And one of the reasons we ended up with a black cover was that prior to Monocle, we did a little in-house print job, a Wink Creative forecast. And I was designing it, and I used black. And one section of that, we had all these brightly coloured illustrations. And I looked at it and thought, actually, even though we're doing something black, this is really bright, you know, in the same way that firework displays are very bright, very eye-catching. And so when I think of black, I think actually colour really leaps off of black. So for us, dark colours wouldn't. They wouldn't leap off. Whereas if we had a white front cover, of course we could use olive. And olive is actually a colour that we really are fond of. And you'll find it in the magazine and in our shops, but you won't ever find it on the cover because it simply wouldn't read off of black. So our hand is slightly steered a bit in our sort of brand palette. But I think bright and fluorescence might not be a sophisticated colour, but I think in our typography and all the other treatment, we still keep the sophistication there and just have a nice smiley orange yellow fluoro.
I wanted to talk now about how many words you put on the cover. This is a conversation that presumably pains and exorcises both of you guys in terms of books and magazines. I've got the current edition of Monocle. It's the September issue in front of us here. As we were saying, it's got that hot sort of fluoro pink on the black background. It's got the cartoon character wondering what he should do as a new job, whether he needs a new job, whether he needs a new destination in life. But there's a lot of cover lines on that. We were talking about some of these magazines that when you buy a subscription, they have very few cover lines on because they don't need to compete on the newsstand for sales. Rich, maybe I'll go back to you briefly on this, actually. When we started, issue one of Monocle was a very sparsely populated front cover. It's quite busy now. Is that because we don't want to leave anything out that we've had an idea on or a stance on? Or if it's just a balance, actually, if you've got some words up here, you need some words down there.
Yeah, it's funny. If you look at issue one, it is very sparse, and we have developed into this quite busy, but I like to think ordered front cover. And the reason we ended up there, I think, is because one of the original sort of, you know, mantras of what we wanted Monocle to be. We wanted it to truly take you a month to read. We wanted to absolutely fill it with information, not for it to be flicked through and here's the same article and now I'm at the fractional ads and all those kind of things.
Or thrown away. You want it to live on people's briefcases, on people's coffee tables for more than a month.
Of course. And yeah. I don't think it's arrogant to say our ambition was to be collectible. That's one of the sort of parameters, I think, of why we're in the game. But I think because there is so much information in the magazine that we try and provide each month, that we try and reflect that on the front cover. So we just try and let the audience know that there's all of this in here if you buy it. And I think one of the reasons the first cover was as simple as it was I think we also wanted to set our stall out that we were a serious magazine. I think that first cover, that first year, we were a little bit more kind of serious and studious perhaps than we perhaps in our hearts were. And I think the playfulness has come in over time.
Adrian, it's an interesting one with books as well. You are not in the business of designing books that have quotes from the newspapers on them. These aren't paperbacks that sit in the front window of Waterstones. Yeah. So you have a different concern. Your front cover is not necessarily selling the book.
Yeah.
Or is it? Is that always the job of a cover?
Well, paradoxically, it actually is, because our audience is the graphic design audience. We've done book covers without even the title of the book on it, because we sell 90% of our books online, so we don't have to put the name on there, because people don't go into a shop, they don't have to browse. I'd like just quickly to go back to what Richard was saying. I think what Monocle does, it says to me that this is a book with written content. I would argue that people don't stand at the newsstand and read every one of those. But what they get is they get a kind of instant message to say, this is a content-rich publication. You know, we talked about brand recognition. I mean, people, if I buy Monocle, I don't read the cover lines. I buy it because I know I'm going to get a certain amount of stuff that I'm not going to get anywhere else. So this drags us back to the whole question of why do we put cover lines on it? I think most magazines put cover lines on because they're terrified. They can't risk someone, you know, not buying it. But I would argue that in most cases, they're actually counterproductive. And if you think of paperbacks, and if you think of, for instance, record covers. Record covers have never put copy lines on, you know. I mean, on the adverts, they'll say, you know, George Michael's new album is fantastic, but that doesn't go on the cover.
No, I suppose the other, reason for the cover lines is to get new audience, you know, because I think people buy because they're very invested in the brand. They just see black, they've picked it up, they know it's Monocle.
Yeah.
It's just as the same as you don't actually read the word Vogue. You just recognize it. You know it's the US or the English one, and you just buy it. But I think you're always trying to get a bigger audience. So I guess that's one of the reasons as well. But just going back to what, you know, unit editions do, it is quite interesting that when you say your audience is sort of 90% graphic designers, and as a sort of a graphic designer of sorts, it's interesting because you really, in those instances, you really do judge the book by its cover. And I do not buy it. Badly designed graphic design books. I have to say I've got almost all of Unit Editions because they are so well designed and they're amazing books. And one of the very few publishers out there that are actually doing very good books about graphic design. But in a way, that cover is super critical because the people looking at it are kind of like razor sharp in their assessment. And if it looks off, you know what the content's going to be like.
Yeah, but that comes from something else that I think relates to everything we've been talking about, is absolutely knowing your audience. I had a meeting with a very nice guy the other day, a mainstream publisher, and it just struck me that he was publishing books, but he didn't really know who was buying them. Someone had come to him with an interesting proposal, and I think what's happened is that people are now super aware of what they're buying.
That's a very interesting point. While we're now moved into the books realm of this discussion, actually, how much you should know about your customer, and how much you should kind of not fly in the face of that level of knowledge, but actually, you know, changing the way you do your job and what your job becomes if you're sort of chasing this Mr. X is a dangerous thing. With a certain amount to your books, you're preaching to the choir, Adrian, but you can't take it too far down that road.
Well, yes and no. I think you can take it as far as, you know, rational decision making extends. I mean, you wouldn't put a book out and say this is a shit book on it. I mean, I've always felt because I've written and designed books for a long time now, and my philosophy has always been most designers don't get to do the sort of work they really want to do. It's a simple fact of life. And so when they spend their hard-earned money on a book or a magazine, they want to see something that they're not seeing every day, or something that that I don't like the word aspirational, but it's a bit condescending. But you know, I want them to say, I would like to be doing this sort of work. So I think with that in mind, you have to know your audience. You have to know what motivates designers. And I did a book a long time ago with a mainstream publisher, and I said we should do a typographic cover. And they said, no, we need an image. It's design. We need an image. We need a shape. We need something. And I really had to go to war with them, and eventually they agreed to it. And this book's been, you know, still in print 10 years later. And I did that, and I made that. I had that battle because I knew that graphic designers responded to well-crafted typography. It's what turns them on. So I think we're in the age of the super niche. And what the internet does and what social media does it allows you to narrowcast. It allows you to speak directly to those people, but you can't patronize them. You can't, mislead them or try and but you can communicate with them, you can feel them and touch them and hear them and listen to them, and then you can create the sort of stuff that audience wants.
That's an interesting thing, that saying that actually knowing your customer, knowing your audience, allows you to be a little bit more niche. You can take more risks. Most people perhaps would take what I just said, will take that question and think that you smooth off the edges of your product, you make it a much more commercial one, a safe one perhaps. Okay, that's an interesting thing. I mean, I wonder to that extent, we do an annual readers survey. I don't know actually how useful that is, Rich. I mean, in the magazine, in terms of actually how it changes the content that we do, I don't think if people say, we don't write about Buenos Aires enough, we get on a plane and go there. I wonder about the idea of knowing your customer. We work in a different arena, perhaps, to Adrian's books, in the sense that we are on that newsstand. We do have high subscription rates, and we do have a lot of brand loyalty, but we do have to fight every month. I wonder what your understanding and what your take is on knowing your reader. And we do know a lot of our readers, but on first name terms, because we do meet them at lots of parties and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But is that a healthy thing for a magazine to do?
I think it's certainly healthier than other social media, and that's what we've done. We actually have invited our readers here. We've kind of got this club family mentality, which I think people buy into. And I think that is a very good way of doing it. I think you'll never, in our game, I don't think you'll ever entirely know. And of course, as we grow, you hope your reader grows with you. But yeah, reader surveys, fascinating. You find things out that you didn't know. Should you, adhere to all of the information completely and change tack? I don't think so. I think the thing with magazine publishing and book publishing, however well you know your audience, you put your book out there, you do your best, or your magazine, you put it on that shelf, and you kind of say, like me. Come and like
us. Baby is out in the your child is out in the world, isn't it? And it's growing up.
It's a punt, and you just have to have as much integrity as you can and hope they come. But what I think you can't do is do focus groups and pander to all the other things that you think might get you extra sales. If we put a celebrity on the cover of Monocle, it'd be absolutely the worst decision we could make.
That would seem very strange.
Yeah, it's just wrong. Even if a focus group said, oh, it'd be great if you had a football article about someone. It's just can't do it. You've got to be true to your cause.
But you say that because you know your audience. You know that's not what turns the Monocle audience on. Just as we know, we don't have to put, popular pieces of graphic design on the front cover for people to sell our books, because we know. And I think I go back to something you said right at the beginning. This element of surprise, just sort of, controlled surprise. I'm not talking about shock or outrage. I'm just talking about surprise. And I thought your cartoon was surprising. I know you've used it before, but it was a surprise.
And it's doing very well, actually, that cover. Great. It's tracking up 10-12%, I think.
High fives to Richard Spencer Powell. Wow. Well, before we go, and this goes for both magazines and books, and I'm sure you both have views on the either, I wonder how different your work has to feel from your peers, if you know what I mean. How different Unit's books have to be to people in a similar sphere, and Monocle's covers. And, I wonder whether... I'm sure people keep an eye on what other people are doing, and you don't necessarily set yourselves against them. But I wonder how important it is to be different, Adrian.
I think it's very important to be different. I think it's important to be true to yourself, to have integrity. It's not just a case of being different because you want to be different. It's being different because you approach things differently. And I mentioned the cover we did, but where we don't. It's actually a book on Ken Garland, who I'm sure you know, Richard. Yeah. A wonderful British designer, now in his 80s. And we produced this book on Ken. It's actually sold out now. I can't get it anymore. And we didn't put Ken's name or the name of the book on the front cover. And we did that because we'd sold it 90% of it on the internet.
You just thought people will know what this is about. Yeah, if they know, yeah. if they're going to buy it, they're going to buy it.
Well, exactly. Yeah. So on one level, you could say that's disrespectful, or you could say it's arrogant or whatever. But it's just using the reality of the situation, which is we're an internet-based book publisher, physical book publisher, and we don't have to adhere to those conventional rules or play those games. I look at our competitors. I look at people like Lars Muller, and you know, they have their own style. They have their own voice and their way of doing things. And I just think you know, we're owner publishers. We're not answerable to anybody. So we only ever do what pleases us and what we like, and just have to hope that it's what other people like.
I'm Rich. How different do we have to be? And this is not necessarily just about standing out on the newsstand, but it's about your attitude and the vibe of you and our other editors and designers here at the magazine. Is it important to be different to our peers and stay different, I suppose?
Very important. And we have quite a rigorous sort of formula. We don't do articles that are in other magazines. I don't use typefaces that are in other magazines. I don't use illustrators that are in other magazines. If our illustrators are in our magazine and then they go off and do a big piece with another magazine, I'm tempted to not use them again. It might seem unfair, but we have to be original in everything we do. We shoot every piece of artwork is original, and that's our game. That's what we've set it up to do, and that's what we follow. And by doing that, we do feel different from everyone else, I hope. Well, that's the intention. And I suppose I've seen a few things out there that have copied us, which is always supposed to be flattering. It's more annoying, but I think if people are kind of mimicking what you do, it's a sign that maybe you're doing something right, as annoying as it is. But I think, yeah, you've got to try and be as different as you can be, still being yourself, of course, and to enjoy that process, to enjoy having your own voice and being original and putting something out and saying, yeah, no one else has done that.
Yeah,
I mean, I think I find that's slightly soul destroying if you're at a, you know, big glossy women's magazine and you've got the choice of 6-7 photographers in the world, and you've got the choice of 2-3 East European models in the world, and it's every month. Maybe you put a celebrity on there every now and again, but she's also a model. And so I think, you know, in that sense, at least there's some freedom. And you spoke earlier about graphic designers not doing the work they want to do. You're right, and in a way it's a travesty, you know, all that hard work and training, and actually graphic designers end up doing 4 years training because they probably have to do a foundation, which that no one really gives them credit for. And then you end up doing something when you're, working quick or something.
Have we got another hour to discuss this?
Yeah, we have.
It's a very.
I have been given a sequel. We'll have to do a sequel in a month's time. We'll come back and we'll discuss this other, the lottery of the art director's lot in life. Mm. Finally, do we have a rule of thumb, Rich? Is there a golden rule? Because a lot of people doing that foundation might well be listening to this program now that they know what it's about. Is there a golden rule to give people, I wonder?
I think just work hard, don't plagiarise. People say that, you know, all the ideas have been done, there's no originality. It's rubbish. You can easily be original. Just be original and work hard.
Adrian?
Yeah, it's hard to come up with something better than that, but I would probably go back to the integrity idea. Try and develop a sense of personal creative integrity, and you'll have to fight for that, and you'll lose that battle more than you'll win it. But if you don't have it, you are going to end up being TV Quick's junior designer. And there are worse things, believe me, and I've done worse jobs. But
and a shiver goes up the collective spine. Yeah, yeah. There's a sobering thought. So how do you design a front cover? You are a bit selfish, I suppose, and you are as different as you can possibly imagine, and you should know your audience, but not pander to them. My thanks to Adrian Shaughnessy and Richard Spencer-Powell. That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.